Yo, this hot, this the spot, there it is, pod.com. We're interviewing the best comedians, so tune in quick and get your ears receiving them. We talking about life and life to stream right to you, from the microphone right to your home, dude. Side note, this might get embarrassing, but no, don't sweat, yo, cause there it is.
Welcome to the There It Is podcast, a comedy podcast to help you find your inspiration. I'm your host, Jason Farr. Let's do this. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a really great episode with writer John Gutierrez, and he's great. We have a really great chat, too. He talks about the early days of UCB. He kind of came in around the second wave of UCB, right after the Jason Mantzoukas's and the Paul Scheers were there, and he was doing so much there. He talks at length about it, and it's great. And he also talks about working at Midnight and writing in general. I had such a great time talking to him. Here it is right now, my chat with John Gutierrez.
I have seen you for a super long time on Facebook because of the writer's Facebook group, Lorne Michaels Fan Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You contributed a lot on there. I thought you started that account, but you didn't start that group, did you?
No. I don't remember how I stumbled across it, but I mean, wanting to write for late night is such a lonely pursuit that I glommed onto that group. I feel like I was the only one posting like every 6 months to be like, oh, I heard about this. And it's more just like, are there anyone out there just screaming into the void?
You are such a resource. And I just remember you always talking about like, hey, I submitted to this. Did anybody else? Like I submitted to Colbert. Did anybody else? And here's the link to submit, or here's the thing to submit. And I just remember thinking like, oh, this guy's really, really going for it out there. And I remember when you got your first big writing gig, just being like so happy for you, because I had seen you for a few years by this point, like talking about pursuing it. And I was like, oh, dang, he did it. That's awesome.
Well, I'll admit part of that is like, I still do like hold to that belief of like, you get what you put out into the world. And especially with so much of late night, because so much of it is like, those blind submissions and those packets that come out that are all word of mouth, that I kind of really cultivated a philosophy of like, if I heard something, then I would pass it on to as many people that I knew wanted it as well. Because it's that web that eventually gets you work. And it's one of those things where it's like, if I can share it, then I'd love to do it. But also, I'll admit, I always felt a little guilty because part of the also like, did anyone submit to it was kind of me being like, so how wide did this go? Like how deep did this penetrate the comedy web to find out about it?
Yeah, I get that.
Especially when you're waiting to hear back on some of those things, it is kind of like, well, you just want any type of feedback at all. Cause a lot of times you never even hear anything back.
Yeah.
So just hearing other people's submissions is kind of the methadone version of getting some sort of feedback from the show.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I submitted to a couple of things, and I when I joined that group, I was still living in South Carolina, and I was like, well, let me just see what's out in the world, because I had started comedy. But I didn't really think that I would ever have a chance to write for one of these shows. And then there were a couple of opportunities where I did get to submit. But I just don't know that it's, I mean, I should take a class and actually give it a real go before I talk myself out of it. But you know, I just don't know if I have what it takes to write. And then like, I feel like I'm probably too old, but that also feels stupid to say, because, you know, there are people who are much older than me who are writing for late night shows. You know, Brian Stack's writing for late night shows. So like it's out there. Not that he's much older. I don't want him to, if he happens to know someone who heard this and them say like, he's like way older. He's the nicest man in the world. Anyway, you were in New York, as we mentioned, and coming up through UCB, when did you get bit by the comedy bug?
I've kind of always, well, when I was a kid, it's kind of an embarrassing thing to admit to now, but when I was like 5 or 6, I became obsessed with Bill Cosby records. My mom had all Bill Cosby stuff on LPs, Smothers Brothers, George Carlin stuff, and I just remember gorging myself on that. Yeah. And listening to it. And again, but having that same question of like, this was just a thing. Like, this wasn't something people created. This was just art. And right. And I remember in high school having that knowledge of, or like realizing for the first time, like, no, somebody writes these things. And so I nerdily tried to consume as much comedy joke writing stuff as I could find, which I mm-hmm. think was like those old, it was a series of comedy interviews they did. Larry Wilde, I think, but not finding much. And then I ended up in New York, moving to New York to write for a magazine called Toy Fair, which was an action figure collecting magazine that was put out by the guys who did Wizard. So it was
a lot of McFarlane stuff in there, right?
Oh yeah, tons of it. It was the house McFarlane built.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was Wizard Entertainment. It was one big building out in Congers where all of the magazines from Wizard and Inquest and all of these things. So I went to work from that, and then I heard about the UCB just as the like people with a friend of mine, I think, had mentioned that, like, oh yeah, they do shows down there and I think they teach. And so it took me a surprising amount of time to get over my fear of driving into New York City from upstate New York. But after that, I started taking classes in like 2003.
Wow. Yeah. And that was an era to be taking classes there.
Oh yeah. Like I started my first class back at their the legendary first UCB theater, which was the former porn theater that was on 23rd. And I drank the Kool-Aid hard, for want of a better term, because I took classes and then I started interning the first week that the 26th Street Theater opened, UCB mm-hmm. Chelsea. Mm-hmm. That was the first week, was my first week interning there. And I had I think then they did like an 8-week internship. And somehow I wedged my way into that I interned for the next 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Like, people kept coming and going and they just kept me on. I worked. And then it slowly morphed. I started teching on some nights, and then I started becoming a pay tech. And then I became the main tech at Chelsea. Wow. So I just like never left. And even when I was interning, it was really kind of crazy, because I would have to take the train out because my car broke down at one point. And so for like 6 months, I was interning Friday nights, working the ticket booth. And then the shows would end like around 1:00. And I would walk over to Times Square and like hang out at the Virgin Megastore, or just kill time until I could take a train until 6:00 in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I still don't know why I was doing that, how I was doing that.
There's a certain time where we think like, well, I mean, this has to be done. And then also like early 2000s, I could see myself making the same kind of decisions, because like, what else was there to do?
Yeah, I wanted to be part of this. They were giving me free classes. And again, it was just like a real sense of community back then. I mean, I've read interviews where some of the people now compared to like CBGBs at its prime, but it kind of felt that way. It was just like this real, I mean, you knew everyone that was performing, like, even though they were kind of levels if people had come up a little bit before you, like, but you, it was such a sense of community, and we're all putting on a show out in the barn type of a mentality that like, it really felt like a family. And so like, I was there, I spent more time there than I'd spent in my apartment.
Wow.
Just hanging out, going to every Herald night, catching every show that went. And it was amazing. I mean, I slept at that theater a lot of times, way more than I should have, considering the amount of rats that were at that theater. But
you must have been learning a ton watching so much. So who were you seeing? Obviously, Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, Ian Walsh, or Matt Walsh. But who else are you seeing during this time period?
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I managed to get right at the end that I at least got one, even if it was just like a one-time class with all four of them. Before they kind of stopped teaching. And the best class I ever took was Amy Poehler did a 1-day intensive for Herald team members when I was on a team. And I just remember her being brutally honest in a way that nobody else had, where she was like, most of you shouldn't be doing this. Maybe you should be writing, maybe you should be directing or something like that. But I firmly believe that, you know, you have to start looking at what you're doing and where you're best at and figuring out where to go. And it was really refreshing. But yeah, like, I don't know if anyone else, I always kind of thought of it as generations. And like, I was like the class below people like Mandzukas and, Curtis Gwynn and, geez, I'm trying to think, like Zach Woods, Lennon Parham, like the Respecto Montalban, Paul Scheer, like those were the people. Like I went to every Respecto Montalban show, I think on Saturday nights for like 6-7 months. I was just always there. But yeah, like the teachers were all, it was all like Michael Delaney and Billy Merritt, like the, like some, really some of the best people. I took a lot of Gethard classes. I never got confirmation of this, but I'm still fairly certain that I probably hold the record for the most UCB classes ever taken by one person.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I took so many free classes because all the time that I was working there, which was roughly about 10 years.
Yeah,
they just kept giving me free classes. So I think at the last time I checked, I had like 30 classes that I got.
Oh, wow.
So that's why I think I might have had, for better or for worse, this might be more of a cautionary tale than a proud tale.
Did you have a crew? Because I know like people like Ben Schwartz had Adam Pally and Gil Ozeri. Did you have a crew like that that you always did shows with?
It moved around because I was on 5 Herald teams in the time that I was there.
Wow.
So mostly my crew was the Herald team that I was on at the time. And like Ben and I were really close. We were on like 3 Herald teams together. We had a 2-person improv group. We did a lot of 2-person improv under the name of Bunsen and Beaker and see if you could figure out which of us was which in that scenario. But yeah, like there were a bunch of people like Jim Santangeli and Gil Ozeri. Like there were people that I, and Devlin Corrigan and Allison Bennett, like a lot of people that I was on a lot of teams with. Uh-huh. But it was just kind of weird to look back at it because it was such kind of a fluid situation because when you're on a Herald team, when you're on an improv team, those people become the most important friends you have. And then when you kind of leave, you still become friends, but it just kind of changes the focus a little bit. And it's just kind of a weird feeling.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, and like, you know, Ben Schwartz has done 2 movies with Jim Carrey now, you know, and he's about to do a third. I mean, I guess they weren't in scenes together, but he's done a ton of other stuff too. But I just mean, he's the people he's worked with now, and you're seeing that, and you're like, I did a 2-prov show with
him. I once, like the most extreme version of that is like, I used to do a bunch of stuff with Donald Glover.
Oh, wow.
And there used to be a comedy wrestling show called Cage Match on UCB, and we wrestled each other once. And it's just such a weird thing to see him now and be like, yeah, I wrestled him. He was Rude Boy Roy, who was a Jamaican wrestler. And I was a father figure who was a 1950s pipe smoking, like traditional father. But when he drank, he would rip off and reveal his undershirt and fight. And it's like, that was just a weird time to think about.
That's hysterical. And I wish I saw that. So during this time, you're learning a ton about comedy. You're experiencing so much. You're seeing a million things. And there's this desire to write. Are you getting to write much while you're there?
Yeah. Although I kind of went on 2 different tracks. Because part of the stuff that I was doing for UCB, I was writing for it. But that magazine that I was writing for, Toy Fair, had a comic strip called Twisted Toy Fair Theater. And that was what it was known for. I think most people bought the magazine for the comic strip. And the guys that wrote it was like Doug Goldstein and Matt Senreich left, partnered with Seth Green and created Robot Chicken out of that comic strip.
Wow.
And so once he left, the people that were left behind took over. And so I ended up being one of the writers on that and being the storyboard artist, drawing out the strips and figuring out jokes. Oh. And that was kind of my real like basis of figuring out like, oh, okay, well, this is how you do a beat. This is how you put the surprise at the end and how you structured that. And that actually started getting me work because that got me, I think technically my first outside writing job was writing for Marvel, writing a web series they did called, Marvel Superheroes What The, which was kind of because of that comic strip. And also because one of the guys at Marvel, Jesse Falcon, was another UCB guy that I knew from there. And so he brought me in with that. He still does improv. He's amazing. But awesome. So, yeah. So I started doing that, and then I started doing sketch writing through UCB. I was one of their video writers on their mod teams, which later became, or I think it was the beta teams that then became the video teams. I was also a mod writer, but I was writing for their YouTube channel. And that actually I got a recommendation from another friend who got me a job writing for Fuse TV. They needed a comedy writer for like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this will be a running theme through my life. I stretched that 2 weeks out into a year's worth of writing for them, for their digital news division, writing little comedy videos and news hits and things like that. And that helped me get some more jobs writing sketches for like MTV and that type of stuff. For
their stuff with Decoded or Decoded. I don't know how they pronounced it, but you did that. So there are those two gigs, and then you eventually are at Midnight. And I don't know. It may have been at Midnight that I saw you post about on the Lorne Michaels fan fiction group, but it could have been one of those that you've already mentioned. How did you end up working at Midnight? And I guess you had to move out to LA by this point.
Yeah, I moved out to LA, I want to say late 2015. Yeah, I think that's about right. And that was another one where I fell prey to, I think, a common improv. I don't know if it's as prevalent now, but I've just talked to a bunch of people who felt like they had the same thing, where I'd been doing UCB for a while. And once you get it in there, I feel like there's a certain amount of people who, once you start doing improv for a while, you feel like you're succeeding just by doing that. But it's like getting all of your needs done. And I'm like, okay, well, this is what I'm doing. And in reality, you're not really doing anything at all. You're just doing improv, and you're performing, and you're not moving anywhere. And so
that's the like hustle culture where you're like on the rat race or the mouse wheel or whatever they call it. And you're just kind of pedaling, but you are staying in the same space. And the culture around hustling does sort of breed that a lot.
Yeah. And so, since discovered, I realized I'm really a person who's like, oh, if things are going fine with me, I'm just going to continue doing this forever.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people do that. Yeah.
But then luckily, my wife, Amber, who was a comedian, we met through UCB. She was a performer at UCB. And she was like, I think we should go to LA. I was like, fine. Okay. Somebody had suggested this. I'm fine with this. So we moved out to LA, and I ended up writing on the CBS Diversity Showcase.
Oh, cool.
For that. But then At Midnight came about, it came out of the blue, because it was a blind packet submission.
Mm-hmm.
And I submitted for it, I want to say in September. I didn't hear anything. I was like, okay, well, then that's it. You know, you submit these things, you never know. Mm-hmm. Submitted so many shows over the years. And then in December, I got a call just suddenly being like, could you come in and interview for At Midnight? And at that point, I'd pretty much forgotten I'd even done a packet. I had to dig out my packet, and I honestly, to this day, don't remember writing that packet. So I have no proof I wrote that packet. But I guess like they'd liked my packet, and they'd actually gone with someone else. And then that person left, and they're like, well, how about this guy? So they brought me in for an interview. I'm surprised I didn't miff it, but I managed to get in. And they called me. I want to say they called me on a Thursday. I interviewed on Friday. By Monday, I was in the room.
Wow.
Yeah. It's always amazing.
Whirlwind.
Yeah, those things just happen like that.
And yeah.
Every show I think I've ever been on since, it's pretty much been like, oh yeah, we interview you, come in on Monday. Take the weekend. But.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend, another good friend of ours, Alrinthia Carter. She had a similar situation where she got to write for Robin Thede for Black Lady Sketch Show. And it was kind of like, well, I got to move to LA this weekend, you know, like all of a sudden, but she's awesome. So let's talk about your time at Midnight. You were there for how long? Was it a couple of years?
No, it was really only the last season. So it was
okay,
like,
last season. Yeah. Okay. It was IMDb says 83 episodes, but IMDb can be pretty wrong about the amount of like the number of episodes someone worked on. Cause it's often wrong.
That is correct. It's 80. It's an insane amount. And yeah. I had to go to the Writers Guild for it, because we were doing 4 episodes a week. So you think about that. But like for the longest time, the Writers Guild had it just as one episode. I had to be like, no, there was 83 episodes. And then they like, if you look on my like my Writers Guild find a writer profile, it's like, it's still just one listing of like, as opposed to every single episode I wrote on, it's like one episode of 83 episodes. I'm like, oh, well, wow. That doesn't really look as good, but,
yeah.
But yeah, it was 83 episodes. I mean, we were cranking them out. Like sometimes you'd crank out 3 episodes a day. So wow. it was a real, I mean, it was, when I got there, it was running incredibly smoothly. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a well-oiled machine with some of the best writers I've ever worked with. That was a dream job.
Oh, wow.
I still dream of that job, literally.
Wow. Sometimes. When you were writing at midnight, or at midnight, how many people were on the staff for writing?
Let's see, six or seven. It was, I can name them off. It's easier for me to name them off. It was Chelsea Davison, Nick Weiger, Jordan Morris, Dave Thomason, Jesse Joyce, Blaine Kapach, Emily Fleming, and myself. And I hope I didn't forget anyone in there. So it was eight people, and our head writer, Joe Rendazzo. So yeah, so it was a good mix. Mm-hmm. And again, like, I could tell stories of all of them. They're just amazing. Blaine Kapach, if you've ever gone online and read his Twitter account, he is one of the greatest joke writers you will ever see. My hobby is cheerleading for Blaine Kapach. He's just such a great guy and just an amazing joke writer. Like, if you're ever, I've told people, like, if you're ever studying monologue jokes or joke structure, like, during the quarantine, when I don't remember who was, maybe Rolling Stones did the top 500 albums of all time. Mm-hmm. They did that list. He on Twitter, just on a date, and was like, all right, I'll do my top 500. And he did 500 joke record titles. And just one after another. It was this massive list that took all day to scroll through. And it's every type of joke imaginable. There's recurring bits. There's character bits. There's an ongoing feud between Mrs. Fields and Aunt Anne's of the pretzel company that, like, that are all told, again, through record titles. It's just amazing. It's just an amazing thing to see. It's just wonderful.
People don't realize just how much late night writers write, because, I mean, and I've heard the stories of people who were writing for Fallon or someone, and they would turn in like 100 jokes a day. And I would go, whenever I go to tell people that, I go, 100 jokes, that has to be wrong somehow. But then it keeps getting confirmed that, yeah, each writer is probably turning in anywhere from 50 to 100 jokes a day.
Yeah, I'd say probably on at midnight I did that, because it, like, at midnight was such an interesting thing. And yeah, I think I can talk about it. It's like, the way that it was done, because there was all, I mean, there were always people who were like, oh, at midnight, everything was rewritten by everybody. And like the people performing didn't. It's like, no, it was this very interesting mix, because every contestant could decide what they wanted to write. You know, they wrote them stuff, and you had contestants come in. We would give them what the setups were, and then they would write their own punchlines off of it. But we would always give them, for want of a better term, examples. So for every punchline, for every setup they'd get of, like, of a question, we would give them a page of punchlines. And so, like, when we in our day would, we would come in, we would have like a research meeting where the researchers would come up with a bunch of stories and we talk about what we want to do. And then we'd like assign out stories and be like, oh, I'd like to write that story about Donald Trump getting into Japanese pro wrestling or something like that. And then, so we'd be assigned those things. And then when your stuff was done, we'd have like a first meeting where you run through, and then we'd have punch up meetings. But when you were done with whatever you were writing that day, your job was to go through all of those and just write punchlines.
Dang.
You would write punchlines and punchlines. And so when the contestants would come in, they would get a thick sheaf of, for everyone, like, these are the questions. This is the joke set up. Here are 100 examples. And it was just punching them out. You'd punch them out. And for me, the best part of this, and I still love it, and again, it was the most amazing part of it, is when the afternoon would come, when the guests would come in, say, around noon on an average day, if we're just shooting one a day, would be, they'd come in around noon. And each contestant would get a personal writer, like a bespoke writer.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be like jockeying for them. Like, I'd like to work with this guy. Mm-hmm. And so you would get assigned to them, you would bring them the packet and be like, okay, well, these are the segments. You'd run through them with it. And then you'd say, like, you can come up with anything you'd like to write, or you can choose any of these if you like one of these, or you can change it to your things, or I, as your writer, we can sit here and we can just come up with ideas. We'll flesh them out. Like, if you got half an idea, like, I'll pitch off of you. And it was just writing in their style. And it was the most amazing experience I've ever had. Like,
yeah. And super informative. People have heard about joke writers before, about someone who wrote for Larry the Cable Guy or something. And it's just like writing in the voice of this character. If you're working on a show like that, you're working with at least 4 voices a week. It's going to be a fraction of what you worked with that week. So you're having to be real quick and picking up on people's style and voice and rhythms.
Yeah. And it was just a very interesting exercise, because your default mode was you're writing for Hardwick because he was the host. He's right. Delivering the monologues. And then, yeah, you're sitting down, you're writing kind of generic. When you were doing like your packet, you would a lot of times think about who might be here. Like, oh, this might be something. This might be good for Duke Godfrey. Like, I'll put that in there. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, when you're working with them, like I got to work, like, just as off the top of my head, I got to work with Scott Thompson, the Kids in the Hall, once.
Wow.
And yeah, it's just like sitting here and coming like, okay, well, we need this idea. What were you thinking? And he's like, oh, how about this? And maybe I'd pitch a little bit off of that. But yeah, you'd be like, yeah, I want to do this. And you just log it in and go from there.
That's amazing. That must be an amazing experience, getting to work with someone like Scott Thompson and the other people you got to work with like that, and just riff.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I should have kept a list of all the people that I got to do, but like off the top of my head, I got to do that with Howie Mandel, Penn and Teller, which was really nice. Like that, they actually let me produce 2 episodes of the show.
Oh, cool.
Because they had a tradition where if they were doing, they do like theme days, if you know, like special themed episodes. And if you came up with a theme, then they would let you produce it, where essentially you would meet with the art department and figure it out, and you'd be in charge. You'd essentially be the head writer of it. And so I pitched a Star Wars episode. But then I also, I'm still proud of it. It's one of the proudest things I've ever done in a TV capacity, was they came to us with a problem one day, which was Penn and Teller wanted to do the show, and Hardwick wanted it to be a special show themed around them. But the problem was Penn and Teller couldn't be there early for rehearsals. Like, they had to be there on day. So you couldn't do, like, how do you do a special themed episode when they have to be getting it on the fly? Like, how does that work? And so they threw that question to us with the writers, like, how would you solve that? And I'm still proud of this to this day. I came back to them, I was like, what if we do it as a Vegas themed episode? Like, they're synonymous with Vegas. Yeah. So we theme the entire, we do a Vegas version of At Midnight. We get some showgirls, we do like jazzy tunes, Hardwick comes out in a tuxedo, we get a third member who is a comedian who's known for doing Vegas, we do At Vegas At Midnight. And they went with it. So I got to produce that episode. And so part of that was working with Penn and Teller. So it was like, they were like, okay, so who's going to prep them? Who's going to work with them? And so I prepped Teller, and Blaine Kapach did Penn. And so we just sat down and tried to figure out how, like, what they could do, especially with Teller, because he can't talk. So it was all like, what magic tricks? And so I'll admit, I was a magic nerd growing up. So part of me was like, he would suggest, what if we do this? I was like, oh, what if we do this? And it was just a really nice little, I'm still proud of it to this day, but I still think of it as a very elegant little solution to a problem we had on the show. So
yeah, you should be proud of that. That's really cool. Yeah, you know, again, it's like, oh, you got to work with these amazing people. Was there a trick that you would try to employ to pick up on a comedian's style, or were you just pretty much familiar with them because they were well known?
It's pretty much just what they're known for.
Yeah.
Like, I felt like I got better. Like, I'll admit, when I started At Midnight, I was terrified. And I'll say this, there was another writer on there, Emily Fleming, who was a stand-up, mm-hmm. who we started on the same day. And I feel like when I look back on those days, I just remember us like clinging to each other, like castaways on a sinking ship. Like I feel like neither one of us would have gotten through it without the other one. And I thank her for that. But we were so terrified. And it was like, oh, these are amazing joke writers. Because again, it's one thing to be put into a room with writers, and these are some of the greatest joke writers I've ever heard, just off the top of your head. And so like, I remember sitting down and being like, okay, I need to sit down and codify everything I know about joke writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I it sounds so nerdy, but I essentially like made a fake book for myself of how do monologue jokes work for me? What are types of monologue jokes? And it sounds so nerdy and ridiculous when I say it out loud. And I always feel kind of dirty in that way, that I feel like I'm one of those guys who's like, oh, I've discovered the one way you write jokes, and you get to see those Facebook ads. But like, I really sat down and was like, okay, well, what jokes work for me? How does this work? How does this, like, I broke it down in all of my off hours, and I focused on it. And I'd like to think I was getting pretty good by the end of it. But yeah, it was just like figuring out so much of setup punch that I kind of didn't know. Cause again, I was more sketch. Like, I still don't know how I did that packet, but yeah.
One thing I was wondering, I was talking to someone recently about After Midnight, and you would know that you haven't worked there, so I'm not asking you, like, what are they doing about this? But I was wondering if After Midnight would get, like, maybe actors or celebrities who don't do comedy on there, because since that's a typical thing for a late-night show. But I thought, I bet a lot of actors would be scared to do the comedy. But even with the writers there being there to help them, I bet some people be like, nah, I don't want to get in trouble. I mean, was that something you ran into at Midnight?
Well, not so much for me. Like, we had some actors on that I worked with, but they were all great. At Midnight, we wrote so much stuff for everybody. And that was the whole philosophy behind the whole show, was we gave the guests so much that they could choose from and then help them write whatever they wanted to do. So, like, you cover your bases on it. Yeah. And so, like, that's always been my ideal situation, I think, is that. It's like, yeah, you get a bunch of talented writers, you have them write as much as possible to the point where maybe you're overworking them, and then you choose the best stuff. And that's, you know, the best comedy comes from overwriting, I always feel like. Because again, like, I think the whole philosophy of the show at the time was to make people feel comfortable. Mm. To, like, give every type of support of, don't worry, you're in good hands. Mm-hmm. You know, we're bringing you as many jokes as you can. Like, we're going to help you get through this, even if you're not known. And like, I just felt like it was meant to be a big hug. And I feel like I talked to some people who were like, oh yeah, I heard from this person, and that it was a real open thing. I don't want to name names, but I do know that while I was there, there was one actress who went on the show who the day of taping was like, I can't do this. I don't know what this show was. Like, maybe she didn't understand, like, how it was or how it was sold to her or something like that. And she got really terrified, but she ended up doing the show and it ended up doing fine. But like, the straight actors that I prepped, as opposed to the comedians, yeah, they roll with it. They just thought it was having fun and, you know, just we're going to have a good time.
Yeah. That's some of the behind the scenes stuff people don't necessarily see. I mean, I've heard stories about how many times Lorne has to talk the host down. Mm. On Saturday, like before, like at 11 p.m. on Saturday, having to be like, you're going to do fine. Because the person's freaking out, like, oh no, this is so much. Like, what if I stink at this? What if this is so horrible? It's like, you're going to do fine. It'll be great. Like, he just finds a way to talk them down. So, you know, it's great to hear that at Midnight, I imagine After Midnight is doing it as this big hug of like, hey, let's all have fun. We got your back. You know, this is, you're going to do great, because we totally had, like, here's a whole page of jokes for you, you know?
Yeah, and I think especially, too, I think there was a certain amount of people, like guests, who were afraid that the humor was based on the contestants themselves, mm-hmm. that it was, like, making fun of them. And that was never the case. Like, you know, we never, like, there'd be interplay between contestants and Hardwick. But, you know, it was just like friendly banter. It was never to make fun of it. But I do think, like, I do think that one person was kind of afraid, like, oh, I'm going to be the butt of a joke. And like that was never the philosophy. The philosophy was always to make everyone look as good as they could and to remove any type of stress you could and relax. It was just a really positive situation.
Yeah, that's awesome. You also, I see you worked on Mystery Science Theater 3000 in 2022. Was it on one episode, or is it one of those things where they aren't accurately telling everyone how many episodes you worked on?
No, that was just one episode.
How'd that come about?
That came about because of Elliot Kalan, who was former head writer of The Daily Show.
Yeah, I thought, and I was like, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah. And I knew him, weirdly, again, it's another one where that magazine Toy Fair came about, because I met him at like a WGA event, and I knew him because I'd seen him perform, because he'd done some stuff in New York. I want to say maybe at the Magnet. Like, he'd done performing in sketch. And so, like, I introduced myself and I mentioned Toy Fair. And he recognized me and he's like, I know you more from the magazine than from the CD. Cool.
I didn't realize you're at Magnet. That's where I'm at now.
Yeah, I did a little bit there. I think back when that was like Terry Jin was running the project, I think I would do like weekly shows. Like back in 2008, I think I did some stuff from there. But that was back where it was kind of like just like piecemeal floating around doing like, okay, we're going to do this show at the Magnet and then that's it. Uh-huh. But yeah, like I met him from that, and then he became the head writer on MST3K. And I tried to be polite about it, but I would be just every once in a while be like, hey, if you're ever looking for people, I love MST3K. I'd love to be considered.
Yeah, so great.
That type of polite, like, I feel like so much of this business is just kind of reminding people you exist. Like, don't ask for a favor, but just being like, hey, I just want to remind you I exist and have a body and fingers that can type. And then and then sometimes that leads to that. And then this last season, he'd stepped off. I think he wrote on maybe a couple episodes, but he wasn't the head writer anymore. It was split between Jonah and Joel, but they were looking for a few new people and he recommended me. So they brought me on in one episode of the show and it continued. My career has been a long line of me contributing to things I loved as a kid that are just still now around. I wrote for Mad Magazine. I wrote on the National Lampoon podcast years after that was kind of a thing. So it's so it was nice to have MST3K put on that as well.
Yeah. And what do you remember what movie it was?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember because I watched that over and over again.
Oh, nice.
It was The Batwoman, which is a Mexican Batman knockoff where Batman is played by a female wrestler in a bikini with a Batman cowl. It's Rene Cardona Sr., I think, because Rene Cardona and Rene Cardona Jr. are two incredibly prolific Mexican directors, father and son, who've done some amazing movies. I think Rene Cardona did probably my favorite MST3K movie of all time, which is the Mexican Santa Claus. I don't know if you've ever seen that. But yeah, it was great. I mean, that's one of those ones where I'm not sure how much MST3K kind of wants you to talk about the writing process either, but I can say that it was 2 weeks of watching and rewatching and rewatching and rewatching that film and just pitching hundreds of jokes.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So, you know, I had seen something. I don't know what their attitude is about it now, but I remember because I grew up on that show. So I remember seeing something in the early 90s or mid 90s of them kind of showing behind the scenes how stuff gets written. And it really was just like a group of people watching. Back then it was a little TV screen. Mm-hmm. But they're all just watching and making jokes and pausing and laughing and being like, okay, let's go back and see. A lot of rewinding. And so they at least let that much out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where I think I don't think they want the technical explanation of how they work on it. But yeah, I think you can generally say, you write an episode in about 2 weeks and every day you're working on roughly like 10 minutes. So you're essentially like going through and you can log jokes with them. You write tons of jokes, but then also it's like you're watching like 10 seconds of the movie and then you're going back and everyone pitches more jokes and then you go through and then you pitch more jokes. And then you can also just log extra jokes as well that you've written elsewhere for it. So it's just tons and tons of jokes.
And I have a question that my nerdy brain wants to know, but I don't know if you can answer, and it's fine if you can't, but I'm wondering, because you said you work in these like chunks of the film. If you have so many jokes from earlier in it, like how would the callbacks work? Because wouldn't they not necessarily know if they are definitely going with it? And wouldn't it be easy to lose some of those like jokes in the shuffle?
Yeah, I think you can. Like, I feel like I pitch some callbacks as well, but I do feel like that's more of a second layer.
Because
I feel like once we were done with it, then like we didn't determine what got in. That's the hires up. That's like Jonah and Joel and the hires up. And I think they ended up deciding more of like, okay, well, we're getting a lot about this, especially this joke landed, so let's make that a callback. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like a second layer that kind of we weren't privy to.
Oh, I gotcha. Oh, so much goes into writing stuff like this. And I don't know that a lot of people who maybe wish they could write for a show realize just how much it is. Because, you know, it looked like fun. And sometimes when you see back, you know, backstage or behind the scenes stuff, there's a lot of laughing going on. But I mean, it is, it seems like it's all pretty high octane, go, go, go. It is in, you know, a full day's of work. And there's maybe as much focus and attention that is put on any other highly professional, super successful thing in the world that we know about, but we don't realize how much it, how much work goes into writing.
Well, it's I feel like jokes are such an interesting phenomenon in if you look at it from just like a technological standpoint. Like if they're both simultaneously incredibly important and entirely unimportant.
Exactly.
Like, you can't be precious with them. They exist in a moment. You just got to move past them. But like that's why like sometimes I get so fascinated by people who like fight over ownership of jokes, which like, you know, there's a case for joke thieves or something like that. But it is just kind of like, in some ways, jokes are so small and unimportant. You write so many jokes to find the one thing.
Yeah.
That you just throw these out. And I'll admit that when I was younger, that was one of the things of like, oh, like you get when you're a younger performer, you're like, oh, this is so important to me. Like I came up with this. And you're like, well, you know, I wrote 100 others. Like it doesn't matter.
Well, I guess that's also the thing. I was actually thinking about this the other day, too, about that time someone sued Conan O'Brien and his writers for joke theft. And it was like the joke was like something involving Tom Brady and Deflategate and some sort of sexual reference to like ED or something like that, like something a lot of people could have come up with. And I was like, man, why would you go to court over that joke? like that joke. It's not like a whole set that you did. It's not like this 5-minute chunk of your special and somebody stole it and took it as theirs and now you can't do it anymore or something like that. We're talking about a joke that tells what, 15 seconds to tell? You know, like you're gonna sue over that.
Yeah, that just reminded me so much. I mean, I feel like I shouldn't, but I sometimes do like read screenwriting Twitter or like Facebook posts of people. And there's just a certain amount of people who you can tell they don't come up with a lot of ideas because every idea is incredibly precious to them.
Yeah.
And then they fight so hard of like, I created this thing. And you're like, no, anyone could create this thing. Like at a certain level, a joke is a math problem.
Yeah.
And there's so many different angles you can use because you're remixing whatever it was in. Like the whole thing is like, here's a bunch of things. I'm giving you a setup, which is a bunch of things. Guess how I'm going to come up with it. And there's only so many ways you can use that recipe.
Yeah.
So like, but the people who stumble across it once at a time where it's a bolt of the blue inspiration, like they claw and they're like, oh, I need this thing. And it's like, no, you need to learn how to create more of it. And it just becomes less important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's odd when someone steals a joke. But it's like someone stole a Twitter joke of mine and posted it on his Twitter account. And I was like, what a strange thing to do. but I wasn't like, how dare he? I was just like, why? Like, I'm not mad. I didn't even confront the guy. I was just like, what's the purpose here?
Like, but see, that feels to me like I feel like there's almost a weird flip side to it, because I feel like they're the people who are like, I created this. It's so important. It's mine. And then there's the opposite side where almost like, I don't even really think of these as things that people create. They're just things that we have. Right. And I'm just decorating my like, I'm not saying I wrote that. I'm just sharing it. Like it's but that jokes just kind of exist in the ether. Like I will occasionally, it's fascinating to read YouTube comments from. If you watch like YouTube videos of people breaking down stand-up comedy, there's always a certain amount of just angry people who refuse to believe that anyone wrote this in the first place. You're like, oh, like, you know, that's not what John Mulaney was thinking when he wrote this. Like that just came out of the, like, they're so invested in the thought that this just has to be who it is. You can't believe that it's something you construct.
As someone who writes and does improv, Did you always find it fascinating? Because I did stand up for a little bit. Not that I was like a touring guy or anything, but isn't it kind of bizarre that audiences will go up to a stand up and go and assume that they were just talking off the top of their head, none of it was written. Mm-hmm. And when it's improv, they go up to them and go, so you write this, right?
Yeah, I saw a violent version of that in a Respecto Montalban show that I think it was like 2006, 2007. It was a Saturday night show. And that was back when they were doing like an improvised office party, I think. I think that was their form.
Okay.
And it was great. But halfway through, a guy just stood up and just, you are all liars. And like, everyone's like, what is going on? And he just was so angry because like, these people are lying. They wrote all of this beforehand and they're lying to you. Like he was uncovering this conspiracy and he had to be escorted from the theater. But I just never see like, in one way, it's like, what an amazing visceral reaction from a piece of art that you're creating. But yeah, he was so invested in like, I have to prove that I'm smarter than you. I feel like sometimes it's the ego thing. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And then like too much alcohol.
That's true. There's a real question to be asked of whether or not alcohol should even be served in these type of venues. But
when we were talking a little bit more about how much goes into writing something, you know, it's interesting that there are still moments when the filming happens and it's just like so delightful and everyone's like laughing, honestly laughing, even though they toiled over this material earlier. And it's just like a magical thing that can happen when you work on something. But when you actually start piecing it together and filming it, how it's just like everyone's just like laughing hysterically, even though everyone knew the jokes beforehand. Like,
I almost think that there's a weird switch. Like, yeah. I've been doing a bit of reading about spoiler culture, like, and the debate about like, how does spoiling a plot point ruin a movie? And I think there's a case to be made that a lot of people will make, which is that like, if you spoil a plot point is spoiled to you in a weird way, it doesn't ruin a movie so much as it turns it into anticipation. And because you know what's going to happen, it becomes that Hitchcockian bit of like, you know that something is happening. You know that that thing is coming. How are we going to get to it? It becomes almost a different type of a framing of a joke of like, okay, yeah, I know we're going to get to this weird thing. Like, where does it go to? And I almost feel like sometimes like that, like, especially, I think that's one of the reasons why we sometimes revisit, like, I know there are comedy routines that I listen to over and over again, even though I know what the punchline is, that initial surprise is gone. But it's in a way of like, oh, I know where it's going, but I want to still see how it gets there. And it's that interesting, that turn that I think still fulfills that bit in your brain that needs that surprise and satisfaction.
Yeah, it is a weird switch. And I feel like there are multiple kinds of switches. But yeah, I mean, there is the, if it's something like a Hitchcock movie and someone says the end, or like, you know, The Sixth Sense, if someone tells you the end of that, then when you're watching it, you're like, all right, I see what they did. Like the surprise not being there now ruins the experience. But yeah, with comedy, it's not quite like that because there is the like, oh, this was so fun. And I'm just like, enjoy reliving it. And so, I mean, obviously, and sometimes in comedy, there isn't that same experience enjoying watching it again.
Yeah.
But when it is something that's just like so fun to keep watching, then it's just like, it gets better and better the more you watch it, even though that surprise element is not there. And also like sometimes with me, if I had this experience starting in college, if I was filming something or shooting something and when I was editing the video together, I would be so focused on the editing process that I wasn't watching it as like narratively or anything like that, or for the enjoyment that I was hoping to get out of it when I watched it. But then once it was all together, I could sit and watch it and just like laugh and enjoy it, even though it's this thing that I shot with friends and knew every bit of and watched a million times while I was editing the video. And it's just like a fun thing. I don't know what that switch is. I don't know how to turn it on or turn it off. It's just there for some reason. It just naturally does it.
Yeah, I feel like there's almost like a weird, I feel like when you're watching or consuming is probably a terrible term. Like, that seems dangerously close to content. But
yeah,
like,
I'm with you.
But when you're enjoying a piece of art, even one that you really know, you can't keep all of it in your brain at any time. Like, you never have it all entirely downloaded. So I feel like there's this wonderful, like, rediscovery where you're watching it a bit of like, oh, I know what's happening. Oh, I didn't remember that part. Oh, yeah, that slots into that. Oh, it's building to this. And you just get this, like, feeling that you're like, oh, yeah, like, you're completing a puzzle again. Like, oh, now I get it. Like, oh, I forgot about that part. But then, yeah, so it's just hanging out with an old friend in some ways.
Yeah, I have really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Wish we could talk more. However, it's the end of the episode, and I want to create something, and I'm trying to think what might be the best thing. And feel free to throw out an idea, but I'm wondering if there's something with At Midnight you could talk through about how someone, like, how a bit is written or something like that. Like, I don't know, or if there's something else you think might be more interesting to display to the audience.
I mean, I will say that, like, I don't know if this is a process-wise thing, but my favorite part of At Midnight was Friday afternoons, which was the hashtag war days, because they'd have a, like, Friday afternoon meeting with all the higher-ups to, like, go over the week and to go over that, but the writers weren't part of that. So essentially, we would get in a room, it was all of us writers, and we will have all have prepped possible hashtag wars. But the like, one of the best things on At Midnight, again, it's like, it's a very obvious thing, but there was a big emphasis on being able to prove that something worked as a system. And so you would pitch a hashtag, and then you'd have to pitch five examples of punches off of that. But then you would just all sit in a room and we'd test it out by throwing off the top of our head hashtag suggestions off of it. So it really was just like this very friendly, like, nothing was off limits. And there were some that didn't work, of course. There were some that were so gimmicky, you could only come up with so many. The go-to we always use was snake bands as a terrible example. But I think that actually got on the show at some. but yeah, like, again, it was just the freedom of being able to pitch off of one idea and then just coming at it from every different angle. And, like, that was something that really got to me as well, was, like, figuring out how many, like, pushing yourself to come at things from different angles of, like, okay, well, if it's a hashtag war and it is snake bands, like, focus on the snakes, focus on the bands. What are actions off of snakes that are less, like, specific off of, rather than brands of, like, types of snakes, then, like, what are things snakes do? What are things bands, like, what are, like, finding that, it sounds so cliche and hippie-ish when I say word cloud, but doing that second and third level things. So like, that was what really stuck with me as well, was, like, finding ways of taking the connection and bringing it as far as you could before it snapped.
Yeah, I think that's a really informative way to do it. But, like, with improv, and there, I know there are a lot of improvisers who listen, if you get a one word suggestion, which a lot of people are doing, sometimes the first thing, like, you think snake, then you're just thinking the slithery reptile. But there are other ways to break it down. Because, they, like you said, there are the different kinds of snakes, but then there's also, like, you could think of, like, Snake Plissken, you know, a character from a, you know, an 80s movie, or, like, a snake, like, oh, he's a dirty guy, you know? So there are these different angles that can help you break something down. And would you say that's when trying to come up with something that's maybe more unique and less common, it is in... how are you looking at it? Like, what are other things about this thing? Like, what do snakes do? Not just what are snakes? Like, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I think definitely trying to find as many... because I feel like so much of the key of jokes to me... and again, this is... I don't want to be that guy that this is how jokes work. But for me, jokes so much are based on a mixture of logic and surprise. The thing that I came up with when I was, like, figuring out At Midnight for me was... like, the go-to for me has always been, like, come up with the most surprising yet logical thing you can think of. Like, what's the thing that you can get as close to a non sequitur as possible? And especially that little divot before non sequitur where the listener has to complete the logic for themselves. Like, a lot of times that's the little sweet spot. But yeah, like, finding as many ways, because that surprise can come from a lot of different ways, but a lot of times it can be from, like, what angle do you approach this thing as? Everyone's going to approach snakes from, like, some of the obvious things, but they may not think of it as, like, the verb to snake. Oh, I totally got snaked on this thing. Like, that's not something you might expect, but it fits. I mean, so much of this, I think you're kind of, it sounds weird when I say it, but I always think of it as like a game you're playing against the audience, that you're like starting from the same position. It's almost like a word game. You're starting from this thing. And especially nowadays, because I feel like audiences are so trying to jump ahead of you. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like there's a certain percentage of that's always like, I'm jumping ahead. So you're playing the game of like, how can I still come up with something, even though you are moving at the same speed? How can I get? And so oftentimes it is like, you can get a little bit further ahead if you start from a surprising angle.
Yeah.
And, oh, I wasn't even thinking to go down that route. And then you come up with something surprising.
Right. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it reminds me of this joke I heard in a commercial for Jim Gaffigan's current tour, where he said, marching bands have this amazing ability. It's really impressive to take any song at all, any genre, and ruin it. And it, the way he sets it up, it sounds like he's about to compliment. Like that's the thing. It's like the audience getting ahead is thinking like, oh, yeah, they have this amazing ability. He said it's really impressive. Yeah, they are so impressive. And then he goes to ruin any song.
Like, yeah, you complete that logic in a completely surprising but in still logical way. Like my favorite, the joke that I, like somebody once asked me, like, what is your favorite joke of all time? And it's such a nerdy joke, but I don't know if you're familiar with the show Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
I'm not.
Oh, if you get the chance, I'll cheerlead for this as well. It's an amazing show. It was only 6 episodes, but it's a British show where the entire conceit is that this terrible Stephen King knockoff named Garth Marenghi wrote a terrible horror show in the 80s. And they're now showing the show with commentary from the people on it, defining how terrible it was and why it's so terrible. Like admitting that at one point they ran out of time. So that's why this whole episode is like done in slow motion, because they ran out of it. But there's just an amazing joke, and I feel terrible because it's just maybe nobody else loves it as much as I do, but there's a part where they're talking about an actress who was on the show, and she doesn't appear in the recaps, and they slowly reveal that she died under mysterious circumstances, and there starts to be some hints that maybe something bad happened to her, but they kept nothing but bad things to say about her and all that. But then they sum it all up. It's Richard Ayoade as his character being like, and in the end, she was like a candle in the wind, unreliable. Like, it's just the perfect bit. It plays exactly off of it, but it takes you in a way you didn't expect.
Well, Aaron and John, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was great.
Super fun episode. It was really great hearing all those wild stories from his early days at UCB and working it at Midnight and hearing his process. So thankful for him coming on. Big thanks to John again for that. You can follow what he's got going on by checking out his Substack, johngutierrez.substack.com. Also, follow him on Twitter and Instagram at DasGoot1. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at There It Is Pod, and subscribe to our YouTube channel at There It Is, and follow me on Twitter at Jason Farr Jokes and Instagram at Jason Farr Picks. Also subscribe to our comedy lifestyle newsletter and support us if you can. We have a Patreon and a PayPal. Go to thereitispod.com for newsletter and support info. Links in bio. We have some really great episodes coming up. Can't wait to share them with you. Until next time, be good to each other.
The music for the theme song was created by Neil Brooks. The rap was written and performed by Nick Acevedo. The logo for There It Is was created by Jeff Prater. The There It Is podcast is produced by Jason Farr.